stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, friends and family. I always feel excited after listening to the homegrown folks, like I should do a little dance and song and break out the tap shoes, even though I never tap danced in life. But, you know, whatever. That's just the experience you get on Sunday mornings with the folks from homegrown. And then we break down into the more serious banter here at Wake Up Call. My friend today, Sean Tubbs, has agreed to come in. Sean is the senior reporter with Charlottesville Tomorrow. If you know their logo, which you should by now, you'll see them all over the place. Sean is a senior reporter for Charlottesville Tomorrow, cvilletomorrow.org. We're going to be discussing area population growth. Sean has received multiple awards, including 4 first place awards from the Virginia Press Association. Good morning, Sean Tubbs.
Good morning, Rick. It's good to be back on your show.
Well, thank you. This is Sunday Morning Wake Up Call 2.0. Sean was multiple guest at the old Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Those are the folks I hit to come in here now.
Well, no, this is certainly it's good to be back. It's good that your show's back on. And obviously, I have known you now for 10 years. I think you've been part of the Charlottesville Podcasting Network since the very beginning. You were actually, I think you were one of the first people to ever be to ever be working with me on that. So,
yeah, well,
so
you were the originator of the Charlottesville Podcast Network.
And it was great when you came back because that means we have more shows. And, of course, the station has so much great stuff that's now being fed through that. So it's really exciting times for Charlottesville.
Well, that's true. WPVC produces a lot of regular content that is really cool. If you're not familiar with WPVC because you are listening to the Wake Up Call on Sundays, whether because you were a new listener through 94.7, because you tracked us down from the old WNRN days, because you listened to the podcast through CPN, WPVC has 3 other really cool local shows that you should check out. And you can do that by starting with Charlottesville Podcast Network. Search WPVC and you'll bring up the other programs, and they're all dramatically different in some format, and check them out. And we can thank Charlottesville Podcast Network for making them available for more than just the 1 hour that they're on a Saturday or a Sunday. And thanks to Sean Tubbs for creating and putting forth to the new world Charlottesville Podcast Network. But today we're going to be talking to Sean with his current life as the senior reporter for Charlottesville Tomorrow. Sean, Charlottesville Tomorrow started many years ago, and I don't want to do the history of Charlottesville Tomorrow, but it started as doing news in places that not everybody was doing it, in a little format not everybody was doing it, but now connected in doing it with a lot of different organizations. So when we say CharlottesvilleTomorrow.org, it's not just an online place. You do it with Daily Progress. You're doing it with whom else?
Right now, our only serious media partner is the Daily Progress. We have some affiliation with WTJU as well, doing some a couple of public affairs things with them. Charlottesville Tomorrow has been around now since 2005. It was really founded to sort of make sure that certain issues were being covered in the community: land use, transportation, development, the sort of things that might not necessarily seem as interesting if you're just looking at the agendas of various meetings, but, you know, sort of these important decisions that get made about whether our community is prepared for the population that's coming, and that clearly is coming.
And so that's going to be where we start today, is with what's coming, the area population growth, because that seems to be a wide-ranging circle of topics and articles that you've been writing for Charlottesville Tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, I think that's really it. If you go back to 2005, it was a time when the Great Recession hadn't happened yet. So there was a big boom going on here, especially in Albemarle County. At that time, that's when there was talk about Biscuit Run becoming a big development. There was the rezoning of North Point. These are developments that haven't been built. And of course, in the case of Biscuit Run, that one won't be built. But you've got a lot of these different places that are zoned for this development. But is the infrastructure there in place? That's really the central theme through so many of my stories and so many of the Charlottesville Tomorrow stories. And now we picked up education coverage about 3 or 4 years ago. So we added that to the amount of things because, of course, one of the biggest drivers in a county's budget is its school system. And, of course, a school system, if you have more people moving to a community, you need more classrooms. And, of course, you need more teachers. And all of this costs money. And explaining this to people, we feel, is these are the decisions that get made in a local democracy. And so we're there to sort of, we started off calling ourselves sort of the C-SPAN of local government. These days, we don't post the podcasts or anything of that, because what we would do is we would set up at a meeting, we would record the meeting, and then send it out to everybody. And then people could listen to it for themselves. Now the communities pretty much do that themselves. So that's allowed us to sort of just become a bit more nimble and write.
How do you keep more people reading your material than C-SPAN does? Because let's face it, C-SPAN is a niche.
Yeah.
And well, Charlottesville Tomorrow is trying to get more people involved and up to date than I think C-SPAN might be counting on.
Yeah, I think that was the original sort of secret catchphrase of Charlottesville Tomorrow. I think at this point, I don't really know exactly, we have the partnership with the Daily Progress, and we work pretty closely with their reporters to sort of ensure that we're all sort of taking a look at this, what's happening in our very interesting and complex local government system. Because, there's a lot that people don't know about. And, of course, before I took this job, I've been at Charlottesville Tomorrow now for coming up on 9 years. And in those 9 years, it's allowed me to sort of develop this this sort of sense of what the canvas is. And it's, it's really the best job I've ever had. And it's kind of exciting. So, and it's exciting to be able to know these stories and to anticipate what's happening with different things. One of the biggest questions we get a lot, of course, is about the skeleton of the Landmark Hotel in the downtown mall. I can tell you everything about that. I can tell you pretty much everything that's happening from where the studios here at WPVC. I can tell you that you'll be affected by the Hillsdale Drive extension project that's currently underway. The redevelopment of the shopping center. There's so much going on and people want to know, hey, what are they doing over there? Well, my job is to be able to give answers.
Well, let's start with some of these answers. So,
but just the facts, though.
Just the facts.
Just the facts.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I think so, yes.
Well, we'll start with that. It doesn't mean that I'll ask you just the facts related, and we'll go from there.
Maybe some context and analysis, yeah. But not that much analysis, mostly context.
All right. So, that sounds... Well, I'll test you on that.
Okay.
I'll test you on that. So... a fact that I did find when doing my homework on today's show, again, Sean Tubbs here, senior reporter from Charlottesville Tomorrow, as we're going to talk about area population growth and what that means going forward and where it has placed us today based on thought, pattern, decisions, et cetera, that have already been made and not made. So census growth, just from 2010 to 2015, Charlottesville has increased 10.9%, and Albemarle County, 6.1%.
Mm-hmm.
So if you put those together, I'm not going to be specific, but a little more than 11,000 people in just about 5.5 years.
That's I don't have the chart right in front of me, but that sounds about right. I did write down just in Albemarle County alone, between 2005 and 2015, they added about 12,000 people. And of course, this is a desirable place. People are coming here. At what rate? It's not as big as some of the areas in it's not as big as the growth rate in Northern Virginia, for instance, and some of the counties like Loudoun. But for us, it's pretty significant.
I found that this is a quote from an article you wrote that says, Charlottesville wasn't growing for about two decades before it made these rezoning changes. So why did Charlottesville feel the need to make rezoning changes? And what were these rezoning changes?
Well, at the time, this is going back, sort of the context for this is that you've got to look at any of these questions and look at it in terms of the relationship between the city of Charlottesville and Albemarle County. You've got two different jurisdictions with two different tax rates. At different times, they offer different things to the community. What I mean by that is in terms of the space. So in the late 90s, the city of Charlottesville was sort of floundering. There wasn't a lot of tax rate growth, and it was pretty flat. And of course, the danger was that if you go below a certain percentage, you qualify for less federal funds. So the local government was sort of looking at this, and there was talk at the time of reverting to a town. I don't know if you remember that discussion, but back in the late 90s, there was talk of reverting to a town, which would have made Albemarle County pay for a lot of that stuff. So the decision was made in 2003, after a lot of discussion, to go ahead and make the place to grow the city's tax base by increasing the potential amount of people who could live here. So that means bigger buildings. It means a more dense downtown Charlottesville. And of course, you know, this rezoning was in 2003, and at the time they set the building heights, for instance, on West Main Street at 101 feet. Now, flash forward to about 12 years later, after the Great Recession has happened, suddenly there's all these potential places to build. And of course, then the buildings go up. And then people complain, hey, well, why did you allow these big buildings to happen? So these things happen on a pretty cyclical, long-term basis. And I think a lot of it, though, is getting back to the fact that another big driver of growth here is the fact that the University of Virginia's enrollments have gone up. They added 2,000 undergraduates approximately between 2005 and 2015. And of course, with that, it's the same as your secondary school students. You need more professors, you need more places to put them, and you just have this driver of economic growth that really is out of the hands of the local officials, because the University of Virginia is a state institution, and in Virginia, localities can't really tell state institutions what to do.
All right, so the city feels the need to do this. Is Albemarle happy because it prevents Charlottesville, or it that leads Charlottesville to not revert to being a town, or because they are so connected? I mean, people can't even tell when did I cross from one to the other. The changes, the rezoning changes that Charlottesville makes have complete positive, negative impacts on Albemarle?
I would say in some ways, yes, because, you know, I think that you've got to look at the county set a growth management policy back in 1980 that constrained the amount of space where you could have development. And so there are some in the county, some county officials who would say that being able to put a lot of the density in the city means that people won't be sprawling out into the county with more residential developments and single-family homes, because there's an option for people who want a dense urban life to live there. And so I think that's one of the reasons, but you've also got the simple trends of just people, the so-called, I don't like using the phrase, but the millennial generation and people who are retiring, they'd like to live in urban settings. And of course, Charlottesville wins so many different awards. It just becomes this popular place. The county, of course, is a little restricted because, you know, again, it gets back to the tensions between the two of them long term, you know, because I don't think a lot of people in the county know that they're paying the city 10 cents on their tax dollar, for instance, with revenue sharing. And that's, we can get into that in a minute, but these are all related. I think the county sort of benefits from it because you've got more people, but when you have more people coming, it means you need to figure out things to do. And so this is what connects back to the tax rate and local democracy. This week, the county executive is proposing a 2.5 cent increase just to stay afloat with the current services being offered by the county. And of course, some would oppose that.
Sean Tubbs here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Thanks for tuning in. About 11:14 here on what has turned out to be a rainy Sunday. I don't know where that came from.
The sky, I think.
Yeah, well, yeah. You know, I'm not the weather guy. Again, we are talking about area population growth. Sean, so Charlottesville and Albemarle with the growth are not are following a statewide trend. We're certainly not in the rural aspects that some counties are seeing where population is decreasing. We're not in the major manufacturing parts of the state. We're not coal. We're not in those parts of labor that everyone around the country is seeing in a decrease. So it's not surprising. But what are the problems that follow this type of population growth?
Well, you could call them problems, and I think a lot of people would call them problems, but let's go with issues for a second, because it's just...
Challenges.
Challenges. More people means, as much as I think a lot of people would like to get people out of their cars, the reality is people like their cars, and so they bring their cars with them, which means that people are on the road. You've got students who need to be educated someplace, but you've also got court cases. You know, more people brings with them... civil strife between people.
Crime.
Crime is another one, of course. You've got people who demand sidewalks. What we're seeing in Albemarle County, for instance, is that you've got people who have been lured here by the promise of a walkable community, which is, you know, these aspirational things that are in the county's comprehensive plan. But the reality is there's no money to pay for a lot of the things, like sidewalks. There's a lot of people who would like to see better sidewalks in Albemarle County. But the reality is that they have a lower tax rate and they have a lot more obligations because, again, you know, the county population is now estimated to be about 105,000 people. You know, that's up compared to Charlottesville's about 45,000. You know, if you go back, it was only 50 years ago that the county had fewer than the city of Charlottesville. So there's been this real trend going forward and it's projected to keep going. So these are some of the issues. And of course, you know, there's many people in the community who would like to change the zoning in the county to restrict growth. But of course, when you restrict the supply of housing, the cost goes up. So you've got all sorts of issues. They're all connected.
Right. It's I don't want anybody else here, but I want my kids to be able to stay.
Yes. And of course, you know, that's, I think, is it's a very common thing.
Which is kind of a national issue as well, as we're seeing discussed in some sort of ways. So we're not going to talk about crime today in any great sense. That's not your specialty.
No, I don't write about crime.
Specialty.
The only thing I write about crime is when it comes to the budget season, which we're starting to enter into now. And, of course, you know, the hiring of police officers because, you know, it's...
I thought you were going to say the crime with our tax rate.
No, I couldn't do that. But no, but we don't really write about crime. We don't write about the jail system. But of course, these issues, our colleagues at the Daily Progress do that. And of course, we do have a lot of great media here in town.
Sean Tubbs here from Charlottesville Tomorrow as we talk about the population growth in the Charlottesville Albemarle area. And we're discussing all the issues and challenges that go along with that. So let's talk about housing. You touched on that right away. And the housing increase, more people move here. We need more houses. Charlottesville has allowed for higher density growth. How much of that is being used for students versus people who would be workplace for students or people who would just be wanting to live in Charlottesville and not necessarily have any direct connection to university students?
Well, a lot of the new construction in Charlottesville over the last few years, a good portion of it has been aimed and targeted for students, University of Virginia students. You know, if you think about Barracks Road Shopping Center and how you have those large buildings that have gone up behind there, you think about the flats at West Village, the big building that's on West Main Street that many people don't like. And then, of course, you've got the building right across the street that's under construction now. So a big portion, of course, and also down 14th Street, 14th Street has been densified. So a lot of the students at the university, you know, they want to be able to walk places. So the market has responded by building a lot of this stuff. But then, though, those students can afford those prices or their parents can afford them. And so the cost of housing really goes up. There was a study released last month that said that there really isn't enough housing at the lowest levels and at the highest levels. So it means that a lot of the market gets taken up by people who can pay. And so affordable housing is a very tricky situation. It's a very tenuous thing. It's sort of a market intervention, which can be controversial, to say the least. And that's one of the biggest issues, I think, in Charlottesville and in Albemarle County, but mostly in the city of Charlottesville at the moment.
I believe it was in an article you wrote that because Charlottesville had so little actual residential property available, that those who were in the upper tier for home ownership and even rental, that those in the, was it the 100 to 120%, you know, people who had a lot of money mm-hmm. were buying property that those who were below them could afford. So instead of buying expensive homes, there weren't any expensive home for them. So they were buying things that were a little less than they needed to buy, less expensive than they really wanted to buy. And that those who might make the $250,000 and who would normally buy that, that wasn't available because those who made more money than they did, they had already snatched that up because the more expensive things weren't there for them. And so everybody was buying or renting something a level or two lower than they might normally get. And that was causing a real problem.
It's certainly it takes up a lot of the inventory. And it's, you know, and of course, if you think about the financial, about the finances of it, when you think about finance, it's banks, of course, after the Great Recession, they are much more cautious about who they'll loan money to. And they want to see detailed plans. And they want people who are receiving loans and developers to basically maximize their investment, to make as much money as they possibly can. So that's why we've seen the pressure on West Main initially to build out to as much as you possibly can in those buildings. Those are, as I said earlier, a lot of those are national companies that are now driving that. You do have local builders who are trying to take advantage of some of the county, especially in Albemarle County, who would like to provide something in that price point. But, you know, again, they've got to go through the banks and they've got to make sure that the banks are happy with the investment and the risk that they're going to take. But getting people to actually incentivize them to build affordable housing, and that means housing that's targeted to between 80% and 120% of the area's annual median income. This is where a lot of math gets involved. And I didn't bring my chalkboard, but it's
radio, so
well.
I don't know that would help.
Yeah, but you can hear the scraping on the and
yeah, and that would turn people away.
Well, I don't know. Doctor Who fans might like it.
Oh, yes. Yeah. All right. It's what time is it? It's 11:24 here on the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call with Sean Tubbs and I discuss the fingernail scratching on the chalkboard. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, heating oil and propane for your home or business, and the award-winning Markets of Tiger Fuel, with 6 area locations.
And back in action here on a Sunday morning with a little rain out there, so you should be inside listening as Sean Tubbs and I discuss where our area is going in the future with all the population growth, all these people moving into our lovely space. How do we help make it happy for everyone? So, Sean, the housing issues as we go forward, I don't know. We want to. I've had folks on the show before for various topics as we talk about affordable housing. In the city, it seems like affordable housing equals an apartment. There's no way around that. There are only so many single family homes, and they are either somewhere near the university that have been purchased by someone with enough money to take care of this and rent it out to students, or they're owned by families, but they're not affordable, not in this area. They're not at the they're not at the federal price level of where you're going to get funds to make it that way. Or so affordable family home is something where you're going to get some sort of funding from local, state, federal government. So all we're talking about is apartments here, correct?
For the most part, there is now there are some home ownership programs. You know, you do have Habitat for Humanity that works with a handful of homes, you know, and gets a handful of homeowners. But there's nothing on the scale that would have home ownership in this. Now, I think that there is a lot of the subsidies come from Section 8 funding. Which, of course, is I think it actually has another name now. I believe it's, but which I won't try to say what it is. But the interesting thing is that, you know, you do have this, and the biggest issue in the city of Charlottesville right now, and one of the interesting things that I have, is how do you incentivize people to develop a range of income types? And we have a couple of different case studies we're going to see in Charlottesville over the next few years. The most pressing one is the redevelopment of Friendship Court. This is the idea where, you know, so Friendship Court is about 11.75 acres right in the heart of downtown Charlottesville. Used to be called Garrett Square, right on Garrett Street there, right across from the Gleason, which is a place where a luxury apartment complex, I believe that is condominiums, where at least the rentals, at least people who bought it now are now renting it out, you know, $2,500 a month for a two-bedroom apartment right across the street from a community where the average income is about $10,000 a year. You know, so you've got this real challenge as that redevelops, as Friendship Court redevelops, how do you keep it affordable to those people, low-income people who don't have a lot of resources and are still trying to work their
ways out. $10,000 a year qualifies as extreme.
Yes, yes. But there's a mix of people there. There's a mix of income types there now that are all below, I believe, about 60% of AMI. But the plans going forward is how do you redevelop that, make it a little bit more denser, charge a higher market rate for some people who can afford it, but then keep the 150 units that are there now subsidized. And the Piedmont Housing Alliance is currently working on a plan. They're going to purchase the property in a couple of years. And so that's one of the big case studies. In a couple of years, how do they do this? How do they buy trust from the community that's terrified that they're going to get displaced and they don't know where they would even go? But how do you satisfy the market? Do they come up with, does the Piedmont Housing Alliance not go for the maximum, but maybe go for some of that workforce housing, which is people who are, you know, teachers, fire people, police officers, all those folks?
Yeah, because one of the benefits of downtown living is the fact that you can you can walk to your job, you can Charlottesville area transit, and all the other issues that are completely taken away from you if your home is made so expensive that you can't afford it. And therefore, for affordable housing, you need to move to one of the outlying counties.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the big concerns, because there really isn't a lot of affordable housing communities. Well, there are. There are some success stories. There's a place called Treesdale Park, which is up on I can't remember if it's Park Street or East Royal Road at that point, which was developed by the Albemarle Home Improvement Program, AHIP. That is all, I believe, all of that is affordable. So you have these different pockets of things, these different market interventions where nonprofits sort of step in to try to get between and to create these homes. But it's very tricky. And you also do have the pressure of, you do have a private market that's looking for land, you've got all these different pressures going on. And it's and I think that's, you know, again, like we've decided at Charlottesville Tomorrow that we think it's important that people understand that the mechanics of how this all works. I'm still trying to learn how to understand it myself, because I think we do want to have a community, and this is where I will venture into some analysis. I think we do want to make sure that in the shadow of Vinegar Hill, which was 50 years ago, that both Friendship Court and the public housing sites that were created after Vinegar Hill and the Garrett Street urban renewals, I think we owe it to make sure we don't do that again and displace people.
Do you see anything, because you attend every city council meeting, board of supervisors meeting, and all the other gatherings that the that our representatives have, do you witness members who are more for the government stepping forward versus some who are more for life taking its turn?
I think that the issue with local, so an issue to answer your question, locally, there are some people and some groups like FAR, the Public Housing Association of Residents, that would like the city to step in and do something right now to take over public housing and to ensure that all those units, and to build more units of public housing, to actually go ahead and just do that. But localities are very averse to doing that, because that means that they're going to have to find a source to pay for all of that. The federal government, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, is no longer funding any more public housing, the creation of any more public housing units. So that's that's a lot of money. So I think that this city council, for instance, is going to be interesting, because it's a brand new city council, and it'll be interesting to see where their priorities. You've got Councillor Wes Bellamy, who is now on the board of the Charlottesville Redevelopment and Housing Authority. That's the agency that runs public housing in the city of Charlottesville. He'll be on that board, and I believe their first meeting is tomorrow night. And I'll be watching it just to sort of see what the tone is, because there was a master plan adopted in 2010, 6 years ago, to sort of get the ball rolling on redeveloping the units, which are maybe not the best use of land in terms of the density there that you could have. And so these elaborate plans came up, and then they didn't go anywhere. They just are sitting on a shelf, and there's been no movement to get this redevelopment going. And again, it's the same thing. It's the same pressures. There's pressures. There's people who want to move here, and there's a market that wants to get people here. So maybe, just maybe, there's a way to redevelop public housing to not go for the market, let the private market handle the private high-end stuff, and maybe some of this other stuff, there's a way to do it. Again, I'm not sure, but this is something that we definitely want to make sure that we're covering and understanding, because it's confusing.
Well, what is Albemarle's role in this? Because Albemarle, whether they want to or not, must take on some of the affordable housing. You cannot have Charlottesville be a hole in the middle of the donut with nothing but affordable housing. It doesn't work that way. You can't have a giant circle of folks with less transportation than others, and all the things that go along with that.
Well, I think that's part of a bigger question, which is how do the two communities work together to solve
issues? They can't work together to make a bus line.
Well, that's I think that's a lot of the question. There's still resentment, even though it's been 60 years almost since the annexation started. In other words, the city of Charlottesville used to have a much smaller city limits, but back in the 60s, began to chew up parts of Albemarle County. So you've got this tension-filled race to provide services for citizens. But back to housing, the county, I think again, I'm still trying to figure out what the county's role is. The county doesn't have any public housing, for instance. The county isn't isn't an entity that has traditionally done that. Now, provided affordable housing. Now, this Board of Supervisors and this City Council, they'll be meeting on March 1st in a two-hour meeting, and one of the topics for that meeting is affordable housing. We have a unique time where it doesn't seem that there's as much adversity at the City Council and Board of Supervisors level, but of course, it's a new council, it's a new Board of Supervisors, so we'll see how that shakes out. But affordable housing, I think part of it, though, I think at the end of the day, it's the people who own the land who decide what happens with it. And so, if you look at Albemarle County, especially in the growth area, areas where you might be able to have bus lines, you might see some more multifamily units be made, but you've got to have a developer and a landowner who's willing to go through the process to get that to happen. Because right now in Albemarle County, it's difficult to get a rezoning. It's difficult to get approved for some of these projects. So some developers are not as incentivized. They don't feel that it's an environment or that it's the highest and best use of their land. So, again, it's a very complex thing.
Well, Albemarle's put a lot of that on themselves because they've let people put these properties together, done nothing to take care of the welfare of their citizens, allowed these owners to run slum tenant properties, not take advantage or to take advantage of the people who live there, not repair the properties and all the things that go along with that, and sit back and say, well, you know, whatever.
I think that's
it's shameful. It's shameful to want to live in this area and know that that's happening, and that we have people who continue to be elected or who come on to the Board of Supervisors and not take that on as a priority.
Well, it's interesting because I think that has been a priority for two supervisors, both Brad Sheffield and Diantha McKeel, who are in the Rio District and Jack Jewett District, respectively. They are trying to figure out ways and to get the staff to move on ways to cure some of the urban blight that you're talking about. Some of that. But of course, then you get into a dance between private property
That's
rights.
That's right. And because they've let it happen, because past supervisors have let it happen, now you get into the legal issues that go along with that.
Well, it's with everything. I mean, the government can't just force landowners to do things unless there's a legal case. And of course, we'll see that coming up pretty soon, potentially, in the city of Charlottesville. It's not residential development, but with the Landmark Hotel.
That's blight.
And
they had that piece of structure fall on a neighboring structure.
And that's the question. The question is, will that go to court? Will they settle? And of course, that's just an example of, like, so for instance, a lot of people with all the new hotels, every single article I write about hotels another new hotel coming up, people always say, well, why don't they finish the Landmark first? Well, the question with that is that, and it illustrates what you're getting to, it's difficult to do that. It's difficult. It takes steps, and it could take some investment from the city. It could be millions of dollars in city funding to purchase that thing if it goes to that conclusion. Now, it could be that owner does it, but these things have to start with negotiations, and it's a... Did I mention I love my job? Because I get to write about all this stuff.
No, that's really cool. It's nice. That's what it's like. That's why I like coming on here every Sunday, is that it allows me and sometimes forces me to do some homework on things that otherwise I can be what I call the first paragrapher, which is to read the headline, read the first paragraph, and then, you know, toss it aside because I get to do something else or it doesn't interest me. And this requires me to do a little more depth. I think I read 15 articles,
Hooray!
You know, to do some prep for this.
Well, and that's it. And I think that's what I like. I mean, like, again, like, I became a journalist originally because I loved explaining to people how local government worked, and to have made this sort of my career and to sort of really enjoy it. You know, we live in a really interesting place, and there's a lot of different issues. And I think that, you know, going back to what you said about the blight and different apartment complex owners. So there was a discussion, and this is when you sort of lose it and you can't really get there. There were discussions about potentially using public dollars to fix one of the parking lots over there This is on Commonwealth Drive. I can't remember which apartment complex, but the driveway was crumbling completely, and it was a real safety issue. I don't know where that one went, but that was a supervisor did try to make that happen. So I'll try to follow up on that.
11:39 here on the Sunday morning wake-up call with our guest today, Sean Tubbs, senior reporter at Charlotte's Hill Tomorrow.
You're listening to the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, heating oil and propane for your home or business, and the award-winning Markets of Tiger Fuel, with 6 area locations.
And here we are back in action. Thanks so much for listening. This is WPVC 94.7. Sean Tubbs taking the time to come in with us today. Sean, we talk about area population growth and the challenges that go with us, housing, crime that we're not going to get in today, infrastructure. We chatted about a brief bit. One of the more, I don't know if lighthearted is the way to bring it about, but certainly, I'll let listeners decide. You wrote an article about a gentleman who lives on Locust Avenue, and it brings up the point about traffic issues. When you talk about population growth, road infrastructure and traffic lights don't always follow as quickly as the number of cars on the road. So tell the story about Paul Reynolds.
Sure. Well, this is a story. This is one that I monitor, and with their permission, I'm on the email lists of a lot of different neighborhood associations to sort of see what's going on. And the area around the former Martha Jefferson Hospital, the Martha Jefferson neighborhood, on Locust Avenue is a two-lane street with a 25-mile-an-hour speed limit between the bypass and downtown. And for years, they've been... Some in the neighborhood have been campaigning for the city to do something to slow down traffic. And there's very little, though, what the city can do or is willing to do in order to do that. So fed up, I think, with some, well, maybe not fed up. I'm trying to be funny when I say fed up. But basically, Paul Reynolds, his wife, Craig Reynolds, she would go to a lot of these meetings and for years was trying to get stuff done. Paul is a retired computer science professor at the University of Virginia. He's done a lot of work. One of his first gigs ever was to track down, was to find a way to track the and predict the, well, maybe not predict, but to track the speed of hurricanes for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. So he finally decided to solve the issue, or at least to provide better data. And so he put a camera on his car. He put a camera on the top of his roof at his Locust Avenue home, and then wrote a computer program that could track the speed of every single vehicle that goes past his house. And he showed me, he took about 45 minutes or so to show me how this works and how it captures it and how it measures it. But basically, he's able to track the speed of any vehicle passing past him. And he's tracked basically that 85% of them on a given day are going over 26 miles an hour. That's what he, you know, so anything 26 or below is under the speed limit. But what's amazing is then he can also show you a picture, because it's all the video is encoded of what that vehicle is crossing, you know, that threshold. So he caught city buses, he caught semis, he caught police cars. Well, in one case, he caught a police car doing about 72 miles an hour in pursuit of a vehicle that had been going 45. So, and he's doing it just to prove the point that people have argued, though, that, well, then that just means that they should set the speed higher. But it's a neighborhood street. For him, it's a neighborhood street. For the many people there, it's a neighborhood street that doesn't have sidewalks on both sides. And so for the pedestrians live there, who live in a city that prides itself on its walkability, this is an issue where he's able to look at to demonstrate with data, hey, this is an issue here on this road. And now what's happening is that people are setting up these cameras in other locations across the city. And what's so fascinating about that is citizens are arming themselves with data that they can then take to demonstrate that there are issues. The city spends hundreds of thousands of dollars on traffic studies. This alternate set of data is really intriguing to me. It's really compelling stuff.
I don't remember if I read it in your article or another article, but a young boy hit.
Yes.
On that road.
That's what Paul had said. He told me that that it was that incident, and a 12-year-old boy, I believe, was hit back in October, and so the issue there, of course, is that he sprung into action, wrote this program, and then started arming data. And I got to find out about it, got to write about it. The story went, for us, it went viral. It was a big story that actually went outside of Charlottesville because it was something that people were interested in all across the world. We'll see what happens next with it. But traffic, of course, is an issue, and it is, gets back to the city versus county idea. There are many in the city who resent that county people in the county are coming in on our roads, or what they would say our roads. But of course, structurally, though, I think the county would say that that's just part of being a city. And also, too, there's that revenue sharing payment that the county makes to the city. So it's not like the city's not getting something out of growth in the county.
And I can guarantee you that if we found any homes listed for sale on Locust Avenue, they all say you can walk to the downtown mall.
Probably, yes. Yeah. And of course, I think that it gets back to, again, if the city is going to pride itself and aspire to many of the goals in its comprehensive plan, citizens would say, this is an issue where you have to take care of this. You have to figure out a way to make our street safe. Now, speed bumps are probably out. Traffic signs are probably out because that road is what's known as a collector road. And it does its job as a road function is to get vehicles from one place to another. And of course, that's and then with development further down Locust Avenue, there's just, these are issues that growing communities have to deal with.
It also probably is some sort of historical road, so you can't damage the sight line with
there's a lot of old trees.
Roads.
Well, there's a lot of old
nasty
trees.
Nasty signs.
Now, an engineering solution might be to just chop down as many trees along the way as possible. But, of course, it's the idea of a tree city. So what is going to happen there is that the city is working on some softer traffic calming things. There's not a lot of money in the budget to do a lot of that. But they're going to put some planters out. But, of course, if you think about what they did with Park Street, I'm not sure when that was
It's been a while now. I'd say 10 years ago.
Yeah, I think about 10 years ago when they added those little places where you sort of have to swerve. The idea was to slow people down, but I'm not so sure that has worked.
It's just a little NASCAR-ish.
Yeah, yeah. Chicanes, I think they call it.
Yeah. Sean Tubbs here, Charlottesville Tomorrow, senior reporter, as we talk about the issues, the challenges that go along with area population growth, such as traffic. Paul Reynolds and his software tracking those on Locust Avenue. So while we're talking about traffic, past visits to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, you've always talked about the 29 Western Bypass. The final decision, or I shouldn't say final ever, I guess.
Oh no, that one's dead. Yeah,
but
you can definitely say that one's final. Well, the issue's not final, but that particular project is definitely final.
But now we're talking about the interchange at Rio Road and Route 29. Can you give us any updates on what's going on with that? Because they're obviously doing a lot of work there. I know that there are numerous businesses that have stepped forward and said, you're ruining our business. What's happening?
What's happening at the moment, which is really interesting, is that I've never seen transportation projects move forward this quickly in this community. it took 40 years to get the John Warner Parkway built. The Western Bypass has been an issue with us for around 30 years or so, but it's really interesting because these things got under construction, within 2 years. So the bypass ended 2 years ago when the Federal Highway Administration said that that there would be no more consideration. Well, that not necessarily that there wouldn't be any more consideration, but they weren't going to accept the previous administration's word for it that this road was not going to damage the environment more than it would. It's kind of complicated, and there's some politics involved in here, because there always is to some extent. But so what's happening now, though, is that within 2 years of that, so when the bypass went away, essentially there was this set of other projects that the opponents of the bypass had been advancing and championing for many years. The grade-separated interchange at Rio Road and US 29, the widening of 29 to six lanes north of the North Fork, and the creation of the Berkmar Drive Extended. Even this Hillsdale Drive project, which is going forward here, all of the money that was set aside for the bypass and funded immediately went to all these other projects. And this administration managed to get them through very quickly. I've never seen anything quite like it. It was pretty much, and now we're, the big thing is, can the projects get finished by the time the McAuliffe administration is over? I think that they're on track. There has been an assistance program to some of those businesses, but I think what the county's thinking more is, what's it going to look like afterwards? So in other words, to those businesses and landowners who own property around the interchange, how do they set the stage for what could happen next? Because it's a significant piece of infrastructure. The county has invested in the Northside Library up that way. Can that area become a little bit more urban and become an urban place? The county is hoping so, because they'd like to re-incentivize the development of a lot of properties around there, maybe to make them a little bit less urban sprawly, and maybe some residential development, which of course, we discussed housing needs earlier. How do you use this investment to urbanize the county a bit more?
I think this comes from one of the articles of yours that I read. From County Executive Tom Foley. What is it? So before I even start, Albemarle County Executive Tom Foley. What is Albemarle County Executive?
It's similar to a city manager. So the county and the city are both under the same type of form of government. So he's basically the CEO to the Board of Supervisors.
So that's a position.
That's a position.
It just sounds like some random guy.
It would be better if they would switch the name to manager, but under Virginia's constitution and the way it's set up, it's actually in the law as county executive. And so you've also got two deputy county executives and an assistant county executive.
It just sounds like some guy. He's an executive where here's a guy in a you know, blue coat and a tie. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so Tom Foley from Albemarle County. I would envision that we would be looking at public-private partnerships in this area. There are some creative things we're trying to do, and we could use Rio Road as a way to try some of them out.
I think what that means is that you've got... I think they're trying to figure out how to urbanize a county with a low tax rate, or if the taxes are increasing, that's going to pay for services. But how do you pay for the capital stuff? How do you pay for the sidewalks? How do you pay to get the amenities that people want, like pocket parks and things like that? As that area redevelops, and if it redevelops, what's the plan? So let's say next to where that library is, there's a couple of industrial buildings. There's one that's vacant. There's another one that could be vacant soon. How do you, as people come on board, what are some of the mechanisms that haven't been used to pay for things like sidewalks and again, like a pocket park or something? One of those is something called tax increment financing, which I don't fully understand yet, but that is sometimes used to finance to the taxes that would be created. That there's like a differential between this is where it's getting really complex for me, but you fund infrastructure through these things, things like a service district where different areas pay a little bit more property tax, but that money goes directly into a fund to pay for infrastructure at that place. Now, let's think outside of just the 29 corridor, though. There's talk on Pantops, for instance. There are some in the community who would very much like to see a pedestrian bridge put across the roadway there to connect the two sides of Pantops.
Right, because one side that has the shopping center, but the other side has what is growing to be quite a suburban neighborhood.
Exactly. And they don't have a safe way to cross 250.
Right. They have to get in their car and drive across.
Exactly. So it sort of defeats the purpose of creating this dense neighborhood model development if you can't actually walk anywhere. But how do you pay for that? Let's say that the bridge would cost $4 million. That's just a ballpark estimate. How do you pay for that? Is there some sort of a way to get businesses to help pay for that? The county is sort of looking, and what's interesting about Tom Foley and his staff, and having watched them now, he's been the executive, I think, for about 5 or 6 years, watching their staff try to put everything together is really interesting. It's something where they've got very few resources, and there's another resource that's being taken away from them potentially is the cash proffer.
I don't want to get into that before we finish the hour.
Which is, I think these are mechanisms that in that case a cash proffer is a I'm going to air quote you here, a voluntary donation made by a developer in exchange for a rezoning. But it's something like, right now it's about $20,000, it's over $21,000 per unit that the developer has to pay. And that money is supposed to go, and it does go, to pay for infrastructure. They keep very careful records of how that money is collected and where it's spent. But that is something that the development community has been arguing for years, that just increases the price of homes. But then the question is, well, how do you pay for the added services that are required, like the police, like the teachers, how do you pay for that? So the county is looking for different mechanisms to pay for things that citizens are expecting. Some of it might not work out very well. Public-private partnerships can sometimes go awry, or they can change and become, well, I'm not going to say which one I'm thinking about, but there's one in the community right now that's pretty toxic.
No example?
I can't give. Well, it's fairly toxic. The
Can you give an example from another city?
No, it's this. I only cover this city, so it's the parking situation in downtown Charlottesville. That's we can talk offline about that. That okay. might be a subject for another show. So there are some who are wary of these public-private partnerships, but the county is looking for different ways to solve the problem, which is, how do you pay for the things that not the government wants, but that people demand, that people want? They want a good school system. They want all of these amenities. And, of course, how do you pay for it? That's the question.
And so a proffer is that when somebody asks for that side of Pantops, which was originally a rural area, to be rezoned and turned into a suburban area, the county said, sure, but for every home you put up there, you have to, we're gonna rezone it into 1,000 home lots. You have to give us $20,000 per home lot.
That's roughly it, but it's important, though, that not all of them are created equal. It was in October of 2007 that the county put in this firm number. So a lot of those Pantops rezonings, I think, were before when they negotiated that on a development by development basis. But in addition to the cash proffers, there's also things that can be requested. So, for instance, there's $100,000 on the table from the developers of Fifth Street Station, which is where the new Wegmans will go. There's $100,000
right, because they
want to
run the
transit
bus down there.
Yeah, but that's $100,000 in one-time money. But it creates, someone's got to pay for that bus line to go ad infinitum. And so one of the issues in this year's budget cycle will be, how much does the county pay up? Does the city fund a route that goes into the county? The city runs the bus system. I'm really not talking about proffers yet here, but all these things are connected. And it's interesting because when you have two different jurisdictions and two different staffs,
it's annoying as
it's
can be.
Well, as you said, like, a lot of times people don't quite know if they're entering from one place to the other, but you can bet that county staff and city staff do. Because, you know, one way you can tell if you're going from one to the other is that suddenly the sidewalks stop.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, though, that it's not that the county staff and the county elected officials don't want to bring those services forward. It's just that the amount of money that they have for such a growing community is limited, and how you get that, how you fund these projects is really interesting. And of course, that's what we're here for. That's what we were founded 10 years ago to do, more than 10 years ago to do. And now, hopefully, we're sort of shedding some light as best we can on how this stuff works.
I have a friend who lives at the end of East Main Street, East Market Street. And if you drive all the way down, the last 200 yards is in Albemarle County.
It sure is.
So you drive on a nice winter day, and the city has plowed it, and then it stops. And they turn left, and that's it.
That's
because
it.
Because there's this little football field that the county is not going to send some truck down there to plow. It's a complete pain in the rear.
It's one of those issues.
Sean Tubbs, will you return in the future? Because there's so many topics that we like brushed across.
Certainly. This is anytime.
Well, I'm glad to have you back on Wake Up Call 2.0. Sean Tubbs, my friends, SeavilleTomorrow.org. You can find all of his articles on any of the topics we discussed today about area population growth. Check them out. Adios, my friends.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.